Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on strategic relocation when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider. An insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft back in 1880, and someone who knew neither the press nor Swinton offered a toast to the independent press. Well, Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world history in America as an independent press. Remember, this is back in 1880, and he said, "You know it and I know it. And there isn't one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know that beforehand, or you know beforehand, that you'd never see that appear in print." And he said, "I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone." "Now, the business of the journalist is to destroy the truth," he said, "to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country, and to sell his race for his daily bread. Now, you know it, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting to an independent press? We are," he said, "the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We're the jumping jacks. They pull the strings, and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes." That's quite an admission, wouldn't you say? Well, you know, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of this Global 2000 program, this New World Order. They're the men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists and these philosophers and preachers and all these politicians and prepare to live through and to survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000, Bible prophecy, and this New World Order, call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational and entertaining. It's informative, and best of all, it's free. You can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And if you're online, you can go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Hey, we've been talking about a book here called The Strategic Relocation, North American Guide to Safe Places. It contains all 3,500 counties here in the United States, and it offers a threat analysis, a safe location for every county. And, of course, some of them score a little higher than others. Some of them are graded with A+, and some of them are graded F. You know, like San Francisco, California is graded F, and Trinity, County, California is graded at B+. The area that I'm living in, he's got graded at A-. If I were going to grade some of these locations, I think I might change the grading on them a little bit, but you can decide that for yourself. San Diego, California is one of those F places. Seattle, Washington is another F place. And he has three sections that he has put into the book. I described two of the sections to you already. The first one he starts off with is is deemed the ideal location, strategically location or relocation. He calls the ideal criteria. Here's what we're looking for. Here's what we would like to find. And then in the last section where he talks about these various counties, you know, and what's the best counties, he says he's got a chapter here called Putting It All Together. So you put all this information together, what you're looking for, and the threat analysis, which is the section I'm going to take up next, and then you put it all together and you've got a strategic relocation. He talks about nuclear power plants. Should you locate near one? Is there a problem with locating near a nuclear power plant? How about on the Gulf Coast where you're going to have hurricanes? Can you locate in Mississippi or Alabama or Louisiana? Or do you have to leave Alabama and Louisiana? Well, surprisingly, there are safe locations everywhere. You can live on the Gulf Coast and there are safe locations. There are dangerous locations and safe locations. And so he gives you a step-by-step analysis of the threats that you face, whether it's from a nuclear power plant or from a nuclear bomb war or from a hurricane or tornado, whether it's a natural disaster, political policies that go on in various states. And in some states, he says this is not a very good state to live in. This is a better state to live in because of the politics of the state, because of the taxes and the tax rates in the state. He starts with threat analysis like this. He says, you know, there are several interesting issues that surround the subject of threat analysis. The visibility issue. How many threats exist out there? How many threats are there? Have you ever counted them? Are they obvious? And what are the types of threats that people most often fail to perceive? The people living in New Orleans failed to perceive the threat of a flood. The timing issue. When is a threat going to strike? When you're dealing with future threats or potentially random threats, timing is very difficult to determine. The degree issue. How bad or how dangerous is this threat? How much damage will it cause if it actually materializes? The location issue. Where are these threats going to strike? Or can these threats strike anywhere at any time? Then there's the personal probability issue. How probable is it that I'm going to get hit by this threat, even in a high threat location? And the cause issue. Well, in natural disasters, are the causes random, and are they purely natural, or does God sometimes intervene to cause these events? And if so, why is that? And is there a possibility that I'll be spared because I try to always do what's right? For man-made disasters, whether they're economic, political, intrigue, war, are these circumstantial and natural conflicts inherent to man, or are they caused or influenced by conspiring men in their lust for power and wealth? Or is it a mix of both? And what can I do to eliminate the hazard to me? And then finally, there is the prevention or the abatement or the avoidance issue. What can I do to prepare against, to lessen, or to mitigate the threat? Can I postpone the time that I have to relocate by careful disaster preparedness? You know, each of these issues is very important, but some may apply to you more than to others, depending upon the category of the potential threat. So let's attempt to amplify each of these issues as we discuss the following threats that you face. Natural disasters include storms, tornadoes, floods, hurricanes, earthquakes, and earth changes. Health threats involve air pollution, water quality, disease, bad nutrition, establishment medical control, or suppression of viable alternative therapies. Three comes crime and social unrest, such as riots, criminal activity, racial or class conflict. 4. We talk about economic disasters such as depression, speculation, market manipulation, controls, shortages, excess regulation, and unnatural growth. 5. We should be concerned about war, invasion, nuclear, biological, chemical threats, terrorism, refugees, and invasion. 6. What about government intrusion upon liberty, such as the conspiracy for control, intrusions upon privacy, property, and property rights, liberty, self-defense, and also religious persecution and values control through education propaganda. And remember that to analyze each of these strategically, we have to look beyond the obvious present-day threats to perceive just what we will be facing in the medium and then the long-term future. So if you relocate to avoid the potentially deadly threats and correctly prepare against those lesser threats you choose to accept or cannot avoid, then you have a high probability of coming through the event, the uncertainty, and the dangerous upcoming period with your life and property intact, or at least more of it than the neighbor next door. At least, that is our goal. So how much do you see? What do you see when you read USA Today, Time, Newsweek, and the television set? So let's begin with perception. You know, the biggest failing of the world today is the failure to see what threats are looming in the future. Part of the reason for this has to do with so many extraneous issues that may cloud your ability to focus on critical issues. We all suffer from both information overload and not enough focus on what or that which is purposely obscured. The establishment media loves to bury issues which they deem would be harmful to you or to the world agenda. Liberals in the media also have their own private agendas, which will also be dangerous to your health, safety, and welfare and your pocketbook. Every day, faddish journalists are busy promoting certain false threats made popular by those who have a hidden agenda and who want to manipulate the public into supporting something that they would not otherwise do without the propaganda blitz, such as the phony global warming or doomsday scenarios or the world running out of energy scenarios. These are all false threats promoted by a combination of journalistic ignorance and conspiring groups both on the right and the left whose leaders and scientific ideologues want to use international environmental law to gain effective control over national sovereignty and private property. These environmental smokescreens only serve to divert large resources to evil causes and then tie up the world's limited attention span on some utterly wasted cause. And worse yet, the dangerous legislative edicts that come out of these international treaties will present a constant and pernicious threat to your pocketbook and to your liberty. These are, therefore, true strategic threats. And I'll discuss the specifics of these environmental threats in the government section a little later in the chapter. Now, most of the threats that we're going to discuss, fortunately, forthright and fairly visible, especially the natural ones, unfortunately, the timing of these threats is not so visible. So the purpose of the descriptions that I'm going to give is not to cover all of the information available, but to focus your attention on the most important aspects. What are the threats that affect you where you live? And this will help you to be cognizant of the sometimes hidden issues that are often the most helpful in foreseeing a threat. So if you already know some of this information, hopefully this review will be good for you. Now, my purpose is to help you see the threats amid the media clutter of all of the extraneous issues. But ultimately, you're going to have to judge for yourself the importance of these issues and then make your own decisions accordingly. None of you will see things exactly as I do, but hopefully you'll learn from considering my point of view. Even the things that you disagree with will be helpful, since it may cause you to reassess your own view, and then hopefully you'll be making the right decision for you in your own circumstance. So work hard at making sure that you're correct in your views, and always try to keep an open mind so that the new or changing evidence isn't going to be overlooked. Now let's take a look in general at natural disasters. Natural disasters are the most unpredictable of the group. Scientists are getting pretty good at predicting certain types of storms after they form and begin to get threatening. But the key elements of what causes this original storm or this original event, you know, causes such as the El Niño weather patterns or exactly when and where a tornado is going to strike, that still eludes us. And it will probably always be out of the reach of human science. But perhaps it is meant to be that way. I don't know. But it's my personal opinion that there is a divine power that gets involved in many of these natural disasters, such as the tsunami over in the Indian Ocean a couple of years ago, and always in fairly subtle ways so as not to be too obvious. I think it's done for the purposes of testing humanity and even bringing a few consequences to various people now and again. So I don't try to read the hand of God into every act of nature, nor do I attribute every tragedy to God, but he often simply allows things to happen, again, probably for testing purposes, I don't know, which is a little different than directly causing them to happen. And I also believe that the increasing frequency of natural disasters that we experience every year is a type of a subtle warning from God that nudges sensitive people to think more about preparedness. And I think he hopes to jar people out of their illusions of peace and prosperity, at least so that they won't be caught flat-footed when difficulties become much more serious in the future. Now, people in general are amazingly immune to the voices of warning. It seems that almost everyone keeps trying to see a silver lining in just about everything, trying to look for a positive future. We have lived for so long without a major downturn in the world, or at least one from which we haven't been able to recover, that it seems almost impossible for people to be anything but positive in the long term. So I try and watch for long-term trends that point to certain critical issues like increasing softness in people or increasing manipulation of economic or governmental affairs by conspiring men behind the scenes. And the trends that I see that are critical issues all point downward over the long term. Critical issues are the issues that are most important. Issues that have the capability to overshadow all of the other issues that clog the media on the 6 o'clock news. In weather, for example, you can analyze storm tracks and details for years. But a critical issue comes before us when you see an ominous pattern of bigger and bigger and more deviating storms every decade, pressing in on certain locations. Why is a changing trend critical? Well, because it forces you to reassess your location. Up to now, you may have survived several hurricanes on the South Florida coast, or perhaps several earthquakes in California. Now, a lot of people now think that they can withstand anything that nature has to deliver, or at least rebuild afterward with the aid of government handouts. But I don't believe that, and I think that some huge catastrophes are coming in the future that are going to forever alter the way we live. But rather than let our recent experiences lull us into complacency, let's keep an eye on these new trends, like El Niño, for instance, and if we see that they're getting worse, let's not wait around for the big one. Instead, we should providentially decide to relocate when times are still good. Otherwise, we'll simply be caught in the panic of a mass exodus and become one of a mass of refugees with all of the rest who waited too long, and we won't have any property or property value to salvage either. So move before the big one, before the last train out, as Gary North likes to say, and you stand a good chance of keeping your life and your property intact. Now, the top 10 hurricanes ranked according to relief expenditures for damages are as follows. In 1992, Hurricane Andrew, $1.8 billion. Hurricane Hugo in North and South Carolina, $1.32 billion. Hurricane Marilyn in Puerto Rico. Hurricane Fran in Maryland and Pennsylvania. And Hurricane Hortense in Puerto Rico and other Caribbean islands. Now, in more recent times, looking at Hurricane Katrina and Rita, they definitely show that there are more hurricanes and that the hurricanes are becoming more and more violent, causing more and more property damage. So Hurricane Katrina and Rita aren't something that's new. We had Hurricane Ivan. In fact, in 2004 and 5, we had all of these hurricanes coming in, one after another, causing great property damage in Florida and along the Gulf Coast. Now, you can see that the South Atlantic coast of the United States and the Caribbean islands are very vulnerable to these powerful storms. So let's notice how many of the top 10 occurred in 1995-96. 1997 will not be as severe, being an El Nino year, where conditions do not favor the formation of Atlantic storms. But the overall trend is pointing towards more numerous and more powerful storms every year. Pacific hurricanes are called typhoons, and they rarely make significant landfalls in North America. The track is usually from the southwest, hitting the Mexican Baja coast, and sometimes they rise up into Arizona through southwest Texas. But occasionally you get a major typhoon as far north as Oregon and Washington, such as the famous Columbus Day storm in the early 1960s. I was living up in the Pacific Northwest then and remember the dramatic falling of hundreds of fir trees as I ran home from school. Storms such as these seem to be felt worse, and then they cause more damage in areas that rarely experience them. No one spends much money on reinforced construction or damage control when the need only arises every 100 years or so. But it only takes one big disaster to wipe you out or to kill you. The Titanic only sinks once. In today's weather trend towards more and bigger storms, I would play the probabilities game pretty conservatively. Overbuild for security and protection wherever you finally choose to live, and then pick the more sheltered locations rather than the more risky viewpoints. High, long-distant views almost always mean dangerous exposure to the wind. And I'll cover specific high security construction details for protection against natural disasters a little later. Now, the map on the following page shows the typical storm tracks of the 1996 hurricane season. And it gives a very graphic representation of which coast areas are at risk. And notice how often they track all the way up the east coast of the United States. So homes built along these coastal areas should implement strong construction measures to mitigate any potential damage. Other immoderate risk threats further inland, which are only occasionally impacted, need only to secure room to retreat to. So if you must locate in a high-risk hurricane zone, then following these guidelines will increase your chances of survival. For instance, avoid the exposed high ground as well as the low-lying land, which may flood during high rains or tidal events. Locate your home in wind-sheltered locations, such as forested areas, and which absorb a lot of wind energy. keep trees in your own yard at a safe distance or tether them together with wire cables so that they don't fall into or on your house. Integrate a reinforced masonry storm room into your home. Then invest in unbreakable acrylic plastic storm windows, such as Plexiglas is one brand name. Add hurricane ties to your roof and walls where they join the foundation. And then keep the eaves on your house minimal to avoid wind uplift. And then select siding materials that are rigid and well fastened, such as brick veneer or stucco. When you live in a tornado area, thunderstorms themselves are very powerful storms and should always be treated with fear and respect. But not all thunderstorms spawn tornadoes. And it takes a certain mix of air masses to produce this ideal condition that spawns a tornado. The highest tornado potential develops as warm, moist, humid air comes up from the south out of Mexico or the Caribbean Ocean or the sea, and then clash with the cold, dry northern air masses coming down out of Canada. The tornadoes that emanate from these squall lines at the juncture of two large air masses are also very powerful, and they potentially can be fatal to life and property. And while tornadoes are touching down more and more in places that heretofore have not seen them, they still predominate in Tornado Alley. And the following maps show these high-density areas very clearly. The dots represent a history of tornado sightings in the past decade, and the more dots in close proximity tells you then that the higher the probability of your being involved in a tornado if you live in that area. Tornadoes do occur as far north as the central plains of Canada, where they experience this same clash of air masses common to the central part of the United States. Mexico has very few tornadoes because the cold, dry air masses almost never get down that far. So as we go through the book, we find various maps and graphs that will show you what the probabilities are in the area that you live in. So if you're living in California, when was the last time you had a tornado or a hurricane come through Stockton, California, or San Diego? You know, I'm from California, and I don't ever remember a tornado in California. Although they have occurred in every state in the Union, your chances of running into a tornado in California are about as good as getting an earthquake in Missouri. It's not unheard of, but it's very unlikely. So we don't need to prepare for events that are unlikely. But when you live in Tornado Alley, like I do, you have to have a backup. You have to have a tornado shelter, and we have two of them here, one in our house and one out in the yard. If I lived in California, I would build my house to withstand earthquakes, and I would make sure that when I sited my house, it wouldn't be on the quicksand of San Francisco Bay. It would be up somewhere on a hillside. So, you know, you're an adult. You can figure out for yourself what the potential risks are if somebody points out that, hey, listen, did you know that you live in Tornado Alley? Maybe you didn't know that before. And that you, just to be prudent, ought to have a tornado shelter just in case the tornado comes by you. Now, I'm going to tell you that here where I live, we had a tornado come through here in 87. We had one in 72. We have had tornadoes in the area. And when I say we've had a tornado here, I'm not talking about my house or my property. I'm talking about my county. We've had two or three tornadoes in the last 30 years. So we get one about every 10 years. And when a tornado does come through here, it causes a little damage, like it hit the Theodosia docks and hit Cookie's restaurant. And over here on our place, we still have some pieces of the signs and wreckage that sit up on a hillside about a mile from where I'm speaking to you now that came from that 1972 tornado. So it isn't something that we're real concerned about or that we're real excited about over here, but we're prepared for tornadoes because this is where they can occur. You don't have to spend $1 million preparing for tornadoes. And everybody ought to be prepared. Why should only President Bush have a fallout shelter or be prepared for a nuclear bomb war? Why aren't all of us prepared? Well, first of all, most people in the United States aren't threatened by a nuclear war. So if you had the nuclear war potential map in front of you that shows where the target sites are, both the primary and secondary targets, and the fallout patterns, you could look for yourself and see whether or not you need a fallout shelter, or whether or not you should stockpile some duct tape and some plastic so that you can insulate your house against radiation fallout and then weather any potential minor radiation storm right there in your own home. Now, if you're living in downtown San Francisco, maybe you don't need very much duct tape and plastic. The blast and the heat should do you in. But if you're living downwind in Stockton, California, maybe you should have a fallout shelter. And if you're living a little further away, such as in Truckee, California, maybe all you really need is some duct tape and some plastic. And if you're relocated in the Monitor Valley, let's say, of central Nevada, maybe you don't need anything at all. And all you need is a little guidance. And that's why I suggest the book, which is entitled Strategic Relocation, North American Guide to Safe Places, written by Joel M. Skousen. You can probably get a copy. Now, I'm not guaranteeing this, but you can probably still get a copy of this. From Swift Learning Resources in American Fork, Utah, if you contact them at 1-800-292-2831. Again, that's Swift Learning Resources, American Fork, Utah, and the phone number is 1-800-292-2831. The book is copyrighted by Joel M. Skousen back in 1998. He might even have some newer, more revised books available. You can contact the author, at least you could at one time, at 290 West, 580 South in Orem, Utah, spelled O-R-E-M, Utah, 84058. Again, that's 290 West, 580 South, Orem, Utah, 84058. He also had a phone number at that time. The number was 801-224-4746. Again, that's 801-224-4746. And he also had an email, which is called J. Skousen. Just J, S-K-O-U-S-E-N, at enol.com. That's J. Skousen at enol.com. Pretty good book, I'd say, on balance. Very detailed, very well written, very well thought out from a professional who makes his living designing safe relocation sites for wealthy people all over North America, probably all over the world. But at least here in North America, and he has a little section in here if you'd like to contact him about hardening your site, or where should you relocate if you're a business executive working, say, for Palmolive or Colgate or somebody, or IBM, and you say, well, where can I live, and I've got lots of money, and he'll probably come out there and do that job for you. But my concern is, well, what about the Jane Sixpacks and the Joe Sixpacks and the Sally Housewives and the waitresses and carpenters and plumbers of America? How about us guys? What can we do to lessen the threat against our lives and our property? I might not have $1 million, but, you know, I might have a couple of 3,000 or two nickels to rub together, and let's figure out a way for us to survive it also. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the law school teaches 8 schools, such as family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The law hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself by calling the Law School and ordering it at 1-417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give out don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Let me give you a reminder that we're offering a new class on health and healing, which covers the alternative methods of treating such degenerative diseases as cancer, multiple sclerosis, and the botch of Egypt, as I call it from the scripture. These degenerative diseases affect about 1 out of 2 Americans. That's about half of us. And we want to talk about how to prevent these degenerative diseases and show you what we've learned over the years concerning disease, and how to use the application of essential oils, super nutritional foods containing more nutrients. And the class includes hands-on teaching, paperwork, allergic reaction testing and training, so that you can do this yourself at home, acupressure, not acupuncture now, but acupressure application and training, so you can find your pressure points and how important those are to your health, and much more. To contribute to your ongoing health, this class will be coming up February the 5th through the 9th here in Isabella, Missouri. If you're interested, just call us here at the law school at 417-273-4967. All right, we're reviewing the threat analysis section. Threat analysis. Now, you know, it's pretty obvious that you should locate your house out of a flood zone or away from tidal waves, isn't it? But here in America, half the people of the country live within 30 miles of the ocean, 30 miles of a coast. Half of us, that's 150 million people, live within 30 miles of the coast. Now, if you want to live next to the ocean or overlooking the ocean or something like that, there are certain hazards that go along with it. It's just the nature of the beast. And since half of us want to live close to the ocean, and, of course, many people want to live right on the ocean. You go down to Florida and along the Gulf Coast, and you find these houses built up on stilts that are right down on the beach. And I looked at those, and they looked pretty substantial to me. I've seen houses built on concrete pilings driven into the sand on the beach. And they're up in the air, you know, 15, 20 feet in some cases. And boy, those houses look pretty substantial to me. You know, I'm a contractor, and I look at those houses and I say, wow, that thing is really built. You know, it's built like a good outhouse, you know. And come to find out, when a hurricane comes in there, it just knocks them down, you know, like bowling pins. And so, you know, for an outsider like me, you know, a kid from California, takes a look at the damage after one of these hurricanes goes through, and I kind of scratch my head and I say, wow, what would you do to build on a site like that so that no matter what size hurricane comes through here, you know, a class 5 hurricane, that it wouldn't knock that house down? And it's beyond me as a little lowly general contractor out here as to what you do. So you have to have an engineering study. You know, you got to get an engineer in there. I had an architect who happened to be an engineer. And I built a tower here on my place. Now, we have a thing here called tornadoes. When a tornado hits a building, they just disintegrate and blow away. But you don't always have a tornado. Sometimes you just have high winds, or maybe the tornado is close by, but it doesn't strike you directly. So we might have strong winds. You might have winds of, say, 60, 80, 90, 100, 110, 20, 30 miles an hour. When Hurricane Andrew hit Florida back in 92, the building code required that the houses be built to withstand winds of 140 miles an hour. And so when we took a look at Homestead, Florida, after the hurricane, it was pretty obvious that those buildings could not withstand 140-mile-an-hour winds. So as an observer, I looked at the pictures and I said, aha, these houses couldn't withstand 140-mile-an-hour winds. So either, one, they didn't build them to the current standards, or two, they were built before these standards went into play or came into play. So when I built my tower here, I engineered and designed it to withstand 140-mile-an-hour winds. It's got a concrete base. It's got anchors that are sunk into the ground. It's got a very small extended roof over the sides to prevent the roof from being lifted off. It's got hurricane buckles hooked onto it, ties, hurricane ties they call them. And then we build it with pull bar nails, which hold 1,600 pounds instead of 300 pounds per square inch. And so we built that building so that it would withstand strong winds. I know that if a tornado hits it, the building's toast. And since I've built it, we've had two good heavy-duty thunderstorms come through here that produced strong winds. I don't know exactly how much the wind was, but I'm guessing it was 60 miles an hour or more. 60 is gale force winds. Gale force winds take roofs off. Didn't take the roof off of any of our buildings here. And then when they get up to, 70 miles an hour, I think that's hurricane force winds. I'm pretty sure that these two storms I'm describing here were in excess of 70 miles an hour. Because I've got screens on my porch, and one of the storms shredded the leaves off of a tree, forced them through the screen, and piled them up like confetti about 40 feet down the porch against the wall. I would say that was a pretty strong wind. Probably not tornado winds, but it was pretty strong. And then when it was all said and done, we came out the next morning and all of our buildings were still there. So our overbuilding paid off. Second, our buildings here are all up away from the creeks and stream beds. Now, we get what we call flood warnings here. And every time that there's a heavy storm comes through, it's not uncommon to drop 5, 6, 8 inches of rain all in one storm, maybe in 6 or 8 hours or 24 hours. Naturally, that causes some runoff, and the runoff is what we call a flood, especially when the stream, you know, goes beyond its normal banks and floods out over the fields. And where do people want to build their houses? Well, I was looking at some paperwork the other day, and out around Sacramento, California, where you good people have the Sacramento River, you have levees. And so you people are building your houses down behind those levees. And then, you know, everything goes well, and normal times continue on. And when there are storms, those levees are there to protect you from the floodwaters of the river. Now, that's normal times, and nobody looks ahead to the abnormal times, when you have abnormal rainfall, when you have flooding. Now, I'm from California, and I can tell you that about every 30 years or so, you have a big flooding pattern comes through. And in the Eel River Valley, where I'm from, we wanted to live in the valley because that's where the good farmland was. And so we would truck in dirt and build our houses and buildings up on these little islands. And then in 55 and 64, some unusual flooding occurred and flooded our buildings on top of these little islands that we'd built, the high ground out here in the floodplain. So that taught me a lesson, and I said, oh, if you're going to have floods, then you have to have a methodology whereby you can salvage your furniture and your carpets and things like that. And so on your lower floors, you don't put down carpet. You put down linoleum. You don't put down chipboard. You put down solid lumber. So that when the flood comes through, your house doesn't disintegrate in front of you, because you're going to get water in the bottom of your house, a foot, 2 foot, 3 foot of water. And I lived through those floods, and you know, people that are prepared for floods, people that live in a floodplain, ought to be thinking about, well, when the flood comes through, it leaves a lot of silt in the house, therefore we've got to get our pump going, and then we wash the silt out. Now, I watch people after a flood occurs, and they're just devastated. I can remember as a kid when a flood came through, flooded the house, we'd already moved the furniture upstairs. When we see the water coming over the levee down at the end of the 40, why, we say, well, we're in for a flood. We don't know how bad it's going to be, so we pick up all the furniture and all the things that are downstairs, move it upstairs. The flood comes through, leaves a lot of silt. We come in and we wash everything out, leave the house open. It dries out in about a week or 10 days. We put down new linoleum. You know, we put the thing back together, bring our furniture downstairs, close the windows and doors, and go about our lives. And those are houses that are built and designed for a floodplain. That's the way I thought things were done. Today, you people are building your houses out of plywood and chipboard. The flood comes through, your house disintegrates in front of you, like sheetrock on the walls. I saw that down there in the south. It would seem like to me that if you're going to build your house in a floodplain, that your house ought to be designed for flooding, don't you? You know, like concrete blocks and cement floors, so that you can get in there with a hose, wash the thing out, dry it out, and go back to living your life. So I just wanted to point that out to you, because, you know, there are people that live in floodplains, and people that are living in floodplains don't build their houses out of chipboard and plywood. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Because I lived on a floodplain, and I got flooded out twice, and I moved everything up, and we went through the flood. We never called FEMA. We didn't even have insurance on the house. Didn't need it. And is it inconvenient? You bet. Is it dirty and nasty and messy? Sure it is. How long does it take to clean your house up? About a week. I spent a week. I see down here on the Gulf Coast, you people, your houses are gone from that tidal wave. So let's take a look at tidal waves. You know, directly on the coast or anywhere nearby on sea level land, you need to be prepared against tidal waves. Tidal waves differ from storm waves in that they're caused by distant earthquakes under the ocean, which can send out wave pulses capable of generating harmonic waves as high as 30 feet. Now, virtually every coastline is susceptible to these dangerous waves, since earthquakes which generate them can be even thousands of miles away. These waves roll outward from the epicenter like a giant circular wake, hitting coastlines in a 360-degree arc. These monster waves can roll inland over half a mile if unobstructed, and there's precious little that you can do to stop them. Even worse, they always hit in a series of waves, and the riptides going back out to sea can be just as deadly as the incoming wave that's coming in from the ocean. For example, on August the 16th, 1976, in the Philippines, an earthquake out in the ocean was followed by an 18-foot tidal wave, which struck and swamped the islands of Mindanao, Sulu, Basilan, and Tiwi-Tiwi. 8,000 people were killed. 150,000 people left homeless. So don't underestimate these monsters if you live on the coast. And if you must build on the coast with a view, pick a small bluff to build on, which gives you height above this kind of massive wave action. And make sure that the cliffs are very stable. Sandstone bluffs and cliffs in California are slowly eroding away in some areas. They threaten both homes and highways. Tidal waves are only a real danger on sea level beaches. On the west coast of Canada, only the lower shallow beaches around Vancouver are susceptible. In America, the Hawaiian Islands have many vulnerable beaches, as does the Pacific Coast area. There are also many cliffs on the Pacific Coast, particularly in Oregon and Washington, which are perfectly safe from tidal waves. The northern Atlantic coast areas in New England and on up to Nova Scotia in Canada are susceptible to these tidal waves produced from offshore earthquakes. A tidal wave in Nova Scotia killed 27 people, North America's worst tidal wave death toll. 27 people. Hardly worth talking about. I mean, if I was just concerned about a tidal wave in North America that killed 27 people, you know, I'd say big deal. But the other day, I happened to have a lady here in class that comes from Maine. And she said that she lived in a potential tidal wave area. And I was really surprised. I said, what? Tidal wave? What the hell are you talking about, lady? And she said, well, down in the Canary Islands, there's a big volcano down there. And this volcano is for some reason, in such a geologic state that they expect it to fall into the ocean, and if and when it does, it's going to cause a massive tidal wave. And this tidal wave is expected to strike the North American coast. And she said that where she lives in Maine, that this tidal wave, if it reaches 50, 60 feet, which is what they kind of predict if that was the case. And there's been some geologic cases out in the Hawaiian Islands. There was one island out there. I was watching a NOVA special or something like that. And there's a cliff on one of the islands. I forgot which one now, but a cliff where the water went up the side of the cliff 1,600 feet. Did you get that, kids? They show the picture, and here's this cliff on the island, and here it's wiped clean up 1,600 feet from the sea level up on the side of the mountain. Now, I don't know when that tidal wave hit there, but they pointed out that that's a pretty severe tidal wave. Now, tidal waves don't kill very many people until we get up to the year 2004. And out in the Indian Ocean, there was over in Indonesia, there was an earthquake out there. And the last numbers I heard, they killed 150,000 people. And it killed people as far away as Africa, India, Ceylon, Thailand, and Borneo, and so on. Now, you know, that those are events that occur very rarely. It isn't something, you know, that you need to be real concerned about. But this lady said, you know, since I live on the coast of Maine, and it's expected that when this tidal wave hits, if it hits, you know, it may never happen, but if this tidal wave were to occur, my house, which is down very close to the coast, would be wiped out. And so this lady said, I put my house on the market, and I'm going to relocate. I'm not going to leave Maine. I like Maine. I'm just going to relocate my house from down there on the beach or close to the beach up a little higher so that if and when this tidal wave does roll in across Maine, and it may not even hit Maine. Hell, it may hit lower down or higher up, that it won't wipe my house out. But it is shown that if this thing does occur, it's going to wipe my house out. Now, there's a lady that's thinking ahead to the future. It isn't something that you need to do today, although it could happen tomorrow. But if it does happen, her house is toast, isn't it? And not very many insurance companies will insure you against flood damage. And you people down on the Gulf Coast saw that. It's written right into your insurance policy. If the hurricane blows your house down, they'll pay you. If the hurricane blows in a tidal surge, which swamps your house and knocks it down, they won't pay it. I don't know why you people need hurricane insurance, because most of the damage is caused by the tidal surges, isn't it? And so that's the one thing the insurance companies won't pay you for. So it tells you that your insurance is about as useless as those, you know, proverbial thingies on a boar hog. So bottom line, if you're thinking ahead, should you locate below the levee in Stockton, California, or Sacramento? Or would you be better advised to locate some other place out of the floodplain? You know, granted, the public officials and your state officials are doing everything to make your home as safe as possible behind the levee. Honest to God, do you think your house behind the levee should be made out of chipboard and plywood and sheetrock? Because when your house floods and your house is built with those kind of building materials, what you have left is a pile of mush. It looks like oatmeal. And your house is virtually devastated. It's virtually a total loss. Do you have flood insurance if you live in this flood zone? If you live in a flood zone, the insurance company isn't stupid, you know. They've raised your rates to where they're prohibitive. So it isn't very economical to buy this flood insurance. So my common sense says, hey, look, if you're going to live in a flood zone, you want to build a house, you want to buy a house below the levee in a flood zone, then the house should be designed for floodplains. And people that live in floodplains in Bangladesh or, you know, out here on the Mississippi River or someplace, or like in the Eel River Valley, they build their houses out of concrete block with concrete floors with a second floor in it, so that you got a place to move your furniture when the flood comes in. And so that it's built out of masonry so that when the tidal surge comes in, does knock your house down. So that your house doesn't evaporate, you know, like it does when it gets soaked up for a week or two with water in it. So, you know, even if you want to live in the floodplain, there are ways to do that. Such as along the Mississippi River floodplain, you know. A lot of people live on the Mississippi floodplain, but they build flood houses. They don't build them out of ticky-tacky. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. And the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.